Jeff and John are the three horsemen. They never get along, they're the three horsemen. They argue about science fiction and fantasy. Fred and Jeff and John are the three horsemen. Ride, horsemen, ride!
Greetings and salutations, and welcome to the Three Horsemen Podcast. My name is John Stevens, and I am horseman number one, two, or three. And tonight, we have a really excellent guest. Tonight, we're going to spend some time with Jonathan Strawn.
Hi.
Who is here. There he is. And helping me mercilessly grill him are my two co-hosts. Say hello to Jeff Patterson.
Hi, Jeff Patterson. Jeff Patterson 11 on Twitter.
And Fred Kish.
And good evening. This is Fred Kish, F Kish at Twitter. And I'm very happy that we have Jonathan back again.
It's a pleasure to be here, Fred.
I am also on Twitter at Erudite Ogre. And I have a bookshop that is soon going to have a huge amount more of stuff in it, and that is CuriousTurtleBookshop.com. But now, let's move on to talking to Jonathan. So, Jonathan, who are you and what do you do?
I am an itinerant father of two in Perth, Western Australia. I am a reader, a reviewer, a critic, a podcaster, I suppose. I've been editing anthology since 1996. I've been working for Locus since 1997 and reviews editor there since 2002. And podcasting since 2010 with Gary K. Wolf on the Coot Street Podcast.
I think you're...
As we know it, the Coot Street Podcast!
That's the one.
I think you're missing one recent role of note.
Oh, and yes, I'm also acquiring both novellas and short fiction for Tor.com.
There we go.
There's always one I forget.
Too many hats.
Yes.
It's the time we live in, though. You know, you always have to sort of have your hand in more than one thing because you never know what's going to keep you busy at any one time.
Mm. Until they all collide.
Yes. Well, I mean, they do. I mean, and the time that they collide is about now, about December. Beginning of December through the end of January, maybe even mid-November through the end of January, is when all projects collide. And then suddenly I'm working flat out for Locus, compiling their recommended reading list, because my job, amongst other things, is to coordinate the short fiction reading list that you see, the list of 100 or 150 or so stories that Locus magazine recommends every year. It's also the time when I'm compiling my annual best of the year. So it tends to get a bit hectic.
It's interesting that you say that, because one of the things I was thinking about as I was going over your CV was, I can only imagine that given the number of projects you have your hand in, your own Infinity series, the year's best recommended, stuff like that, do you have to go into different modes when it comes to editing or curating? I would assume that if you're dealing with like a more personal project, you might have a slightly different mindset than if you're trying to do something that's representative of the industry over the course of a year.
I think I do. I think that it depends on the time of year very much. Gary and I on the podcast talk a lot about the cyclical nature of the science fiction year, and the kind of projects that I work on tend to be cyclical as well. I tend to have a monthly period of time when I'm working on Locus, compiling reviews, interacting with reviewers, and then once a year when I'm working on the recommended reading list. And that is a particular mindset. You're negotiating with a whole group of people. Usually we get somewhere between 6 and 12, maybe more, people providing input into the list. So you're negotiating on what goes onto the final list and dealing with everybody in Oakland. Compiling the best of the year is one of those things that's ambient for 11 months of the year. You're just reading short fiction. 11 months of the year, you're reading short fiction, you're making notes. You know, I've got a spreadsheet or something where I'll make a note of stories that were interesting. Every now and again, I'll open it up, see if I actually remember the stories that I thought were interesting as a throwaway test on whether they actually were. Because I always have felt that if a story is still in, you know, if you still remember a story 6 or 8 months later, then it must have had some kind of traction. But the actual active period for Best of the Year, when you go into Best of the Year mode, is sort of December, January. I mean, January at the moment, mostly. And that's when you're thinking about getting stories, getting contracts. And that is a balancing, a weighing. I mean, you're talking about different modes. It's a surveying kind of mode because you're trying to represent what you're seeing in the field as well as what you like and think has merit. And so that's a particular kind of thing. The Infinity series is interesting. It's become a much more personal project than it started off as. It's become this sort of survey of hard science fiction themes and things that I've enjoyed reading over the years. And so it's a very satisfying way of interacting with writers that I have admired for a long time, or writers that I've just encountered that are really exciting, or in fact, writers who I've worked with but who I would love to see try something different. And that's been something that's been a real pleasure, particularly with Infinity. And then, you know, there are other books. I mean, probably, I suppose, the single most personal book that I've done was Under My Hat back in 2012, which I edited for my kids. You know, I had two girls and I was, you know, who were growing up and was thinking, what out of all of these books would they ever be interested in? And I thought, you know, a book of witch stories would probably suit a bunch of 6, 8, 10-year-old girls, which it ended up doing.
When you work on the annual best book, do you rely on other sources such as reviews? And is there a secret meeting of other best of author or editors, rather, where you kind of say, I'll show you mine if you show me yours?
Wow. Okay. Let's see if I can go through this one at a time. Is there a secret meeting? You know,
No. You know what I mean. I mean, I figured that might be a good subject for bar talk at a convention. What have you seen? You know, what kind of thing?
I guess what it says, most of us are in fairly regular contact. I mean, right now, I think three of the other Best of the Year editors in the world actually work for me every month. Paula Garan, Rich Horton, and Gardner Desois are short fiction reviewers for Locus. So I'm in regular contact with them, and I'm getting their columns. And we do talk about, oh, did you see this? Particularly, you know, Paula will read some science fiction and she'll say, hey, did you notice that? And I'll see some piece of horror that isn't, I wouldn't normally maybe include in my book, but I'll point it out to her. And the same sort of thing happens with Rich and with Gardner. And then at the end of the year, actually, because we try to involve all of the Best of the Year editors in compiling the Locus Recommended Reading List, we bring in, you know, Neil Clark, we bring in, when he's available, John Adams, we bring in, we've brought in Dave Hartwell, whoever else, Ellen Datlow, to have their input, Steve Jones, if he's available, whoever else, and get their kind of views. In terms of your question, do I read reviews? I read reviews constantly. Every single day I am out there looking for new sources of short fiction reviews, and in fact, book-length reviews, either because I'm looking to see who is interesting, who might one day become a Locus reviewer, because you always have to allow for a turnover there. And also just to sort of see what people are saying, what stories are getting traction, to see whether I agree or disagree with them. You know, I'm reading the guys over at Rocket Stack Rank. I'm reading Charles Pacer's reviews. I'm reading, obviously, the reviews we publish at Locus of Short Fiction. I'm reading the Tangent reviews. I'm reading the Strange Horizon reviews, whatever other reviews that I can find, in an attempt just to get a consensus. Because what you're hoping is that, first of all, the most interesting stories of the year will begin to firm up as the year goes on because everybody's talking about them. And also you'll get some kind of a bead on stories of interest, either because you agree or disagree with somebody. You know, there are a couple of people, and I wouldn't name them, who, if they hate a story, I will probably go and have a look at it. And similarly, you know, there are people who, if they love it, you know, I will go and have a look at it just to sort of see. So, yeah, I do. I read reviews a lot. He says it far too great length. And I do. We actually do have a slightly secret cabal, or at least a set of conversations. We're in contact with one other pretty regularly. The one thing that we've always tried to do, though, is to keep the actual process of compiling our own tables of contents in, you know, separate. So I never see say, Rich Horton or Garda Dazwa's tables of contents until they're released publicly, and they don't see mine either. So,
I actually had a more specific question along those lines. I'm just curious what the major differences are when you're editing a best of anthology versus a single author best of collection versus a thematic anthology.
Okay. They really are very, very different.
Do you take different approaches?
Sure. Yeah, I do. I mean, the best of the year is just an ongoing process. I've been doing it now for on and off since 1996. It was the first anthology I ever worked on, was a year's best. So I've been doing it for 20 years. So you're reading constantly. You're turning over what you're reading. You're trying to find new sources to read. You're trying to bring together something that represents, as I say, that juncture of your taste and what you're seeing in the field. You're trying to stretch your own taste so you can accommodate what's happening in the field. There have been writers whose work I haven't admired that I've come to admire. When it comes to compiling a best of author collection, like say the best of Kim Stanley Robinson or the best of Peter Beagle, it's an unlike but not dissimilar thing, in the sense that a best of the year hopefully is a portrait of the year. A best of the author collection is hopefully a portrait of that author's career. The only difference is, I suppose, really, the best of the year is your portrait of the year where the best of collection is your portrait of them. And it also depends. I mean, case by case, a couple of the authors that I've dealt with compiling bests of the year have it very, very, or sorry, best of collections, have it very, very strong ideas about what they wanted in their best of the, best ofs. And occasionally we have disagreed somewhat. And generally, this is their book, so you let them, and maybe that's the overwhelming difference. It's their book, so you let them have the dominant say in what finally goes in. I mean, when you compile the best of Larry Niven, for example, the fact that I love a story may make it likely it gets in, but if say Larry loves a story that I don't love, we'll have a discussion about it. But if he wants it in there, it'll go in. The theme one is different. I mean, because again, it's a little bit more like playing. Like playing jazz, if you like, you're looking to find a theme, but you're also looking to counterpoint off it. You're looking to make sure that you have all of the core elements that make it recognizable and satisfying to a reader, but also that it's varied enough that they're not going to be getting the same thing over and over again. So it's a slightly different kind of a task, though the core of finding stories, I suppose, remains basically similar, if that answers your question.
Yes. That does actually. That's. I was curious in particular about how best of author collections went because of that. That presence of the author is really, the whole kit and caboodle for the collection, whereas the other ones are less about the individual authors, and somewhat more about the themes and individual stories.
And certainly with the best of collections, I've found it quite interesting how often, an author will say to you, you'll be talking to someone, like Peter Beagle or Bruce Sterling or whoever, and they'll say to you, look, you go away, you come back with your version of the book, and then I will come back to you with my response to it, because they're really curious as to what you will see as being their best of. Because frankly, most writers will admit that whilst they know that they have, whilst they feel they know when they've got it right, they don't always know for sure. There's always that slight doubt that this is how anybody else sees it. And I suppose, if you've had a story which has won multiple awards, it's very simple to say that goes into a collection. But what will a hopefully informed reader come back with as the mirror they want to hold up to you? And I think that's been a constant through the process with Sterling, with Stan Robinson, with Niven. They were all very, very interested in how I would bring the book back to them. So,
it's almost like asking a bunch of people to go away and make their own, Led Zeppelin mixtape. and then compare and contrast which songs make it and which songs don't.
Oh, it is a little bit, you know, it is. And it also, you know, I mean, sometimes you find that the author is very eager and shares your desire to include a big, a broad spectrum of their work across the whole length of their career. And sometimes you have somebody who's like, well, that early stuff is rough and I hate it. You know, I would love to. It's true. I mean, look, I would love to and have hated to have worked on the best of Lucia Shepherd. I'm an enormous fan of Lucia Shepherd's work. But it was fairly widely known that he wasn't an enormous fan of his own early work. He particularly didn't think much of the stories that were in The Jaguar Hunter and parts of the second collection, The Ends of the Earth. Whereas I tend to think that they're part of the core of the collection and what should have been a major part of a best of the year. And, of course, sometimes you come across odd things which get in the way of it. I was a consultant on compiling the table of contents, the draft table of contents for the Howard Waldrop best ofs that Old Earth Books did. And neither book really satisfies what I would have chosen myself, but it was partly because Howard's first collection had just been reprinted by Small Beer, as I recall, and they were and Howard was keen not to feature too much from that book, so several key stories were unavailable. So I mean, if I were putting together a best of Waldrop right now of his 80 something stories, it would be a somewhat different beast to what has gone out into the world so far.
Mm-hmm. One thing I'm always curious about for any style collection, either the Infinity Best of the Year or Best of the Author, is how do you arrange the stories internally?
Well, I mean, I've always...
Cord Wainer Smith, I mean, you can do it chronologically. You know, that makes sense because it's a... Even Larry Niven, if you're doing Known Space, it makes sense to do it chronologically, according to that universe. But you know, otherwise, how do you do it?
Well, the old theory that has knocked around in the back blocks of compiling anthologies for years, the tentpole theory, where you pick what you think are the three strongest stories in the book. You put the strongest story at the front of the book. You put the next strongest story at the back of the book. And the third strongest in the middle. The first is supposed to draw you in. The one in the middle is supposed to make you feel you should keep going. And the third one is supposed to kick you out at the end feeling as though you've enjoyed the book. And that's what I started off doing. But what I tend to do is I'll sit there and I will create a draft table of contents with a list of all of the themes in each story, because I don't want you to be reading, you know, three stories where you trek across the desert in a row, or four baseball stories in a row, or whatever it might be. I have the story lengths, and what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to draw you in, invite you in, and carry you through in as natural, flowing a reading experience as I can imagine. So I'm looking for a very engaging, open, welcoming story as the opening story in a book. And I don't really care whether I necessarily think it's quote-unquote the best in that book at all. It's got to be the one that's going to make you feel most engaged and most invited to be a part of the book. It also should ideally be a strong representation of the basic theme of the book if the book is a themed anthology. You want that piece of confidence, you know, that you are in the book you expected to be in. You know, you've picked up a big book of spaceship stories. There's a big spaceship on the cover. You want a big spaceship in the front story if you can, ideally in all of them, but certainly in the front one. I would probably put the longest story in the book at the back, probably last or second last, because I feel by that stage you've gone through a group of stories and you're looking to immerse yourself more at that point of time. So you're sitting there, you're arranging this mosaic to turn it into a smooth, consistent, slightly contrapuntal reading experience. If you have a slow-paced story, I mean, I can think of a few writers who tend to write quite languorously, and so you're going to try and place them alongside quite fast-paced stories so that the reader feels as though they're not slogging through at any time. So those are the kind of things. I tend to sit there for a couple of hours with a spreadsheet with 10, 20, 30 story titles, with story lengths, with themes, and with notes on how they read, juggling them back and forth until I see sort of something emerging that looks like a reading experience. And there'll always be something that doesn't quite fit perfectly into that, but generally you can get pretty close.
Do you find that there's a difference when you have to, like, if you're working with an individual author and you're dealing with stories that already exist and that perhaps a lot of the people that are going to buy the book already know, as opposed to doing something like the Infinity Books or Fearsome Magics or something like that, where you're doing something new, where you're trying to draw in new material that's going to, you know, play on certain power chords that you're hoping to really carry on with the audience? Once again, it becomes a matter of mindset. I'm wondering, how does... Do you have to switch gears a little bit to pull both of those off?
Not terribly, probably a little bit. But I guess what I would stress is that the books are generally done some months apart, where the other projects are continuous in the background. I mean, I am editing for Locus regularly and particularly heavily once a month. I am compiling the podcast every week, working on that. And then the actual working on the anthologies tends to come in... Two sort of workload periods. So there's when you first sell the book and you're commissioning stories, and then there's right after the deadline when you're now working actively to edit the stories, to compile the manuscript, to write the interstitial material. And so that's when you're focusing on it then, you know. So it's not a constant ongoing mindset kind of a thing. I will say, I mean, you're right to say that there is a difference sometimes. I mean, when it comes to, say, editing The Best of Peter Beagle, probably you're going to compile that book in chronological order. It depends. When we did The Best of Bruce Sterling, that's basically in an alphabetical order, in date order. It basically relies on the series of stories he'd been writing being laid out in the right way, because there's excerpts from Schismatrix in it, that sort of stuff. The one that was quite different to that was probably the Vance Treasury, which was laid out much more like one of the best of the year, where you're trying, because that was supposed to be a real sales pitch for Vance as a writer to someone who'd never encountered him before. You know, we had always hoped that it would get a mass market edition and stay in print for a long period of time, be out there in the world, so that new readers could encounter him through it. And so we wanted to sort of, if you like, beguile you through the book a little bit, and so it was paced that way. But no, I mean, for some of the others, it is more a case of, yes, chronological order. And you're completely correct. You know, if you're doing, say, the Cordwainer Smith book, if you were to compile, say, Terry Dowling's Rhinoceros stories, they have a interior chronology that you need to respect. The same is true when we, years ago, worked on Terry Dowling's Basic Black, which had an interior chronology and had to work in a particular way. But... the other books, you know, less so. So you have much more freedom to move things around to work smoothly.
That's a lot to absorb.
Sorry,
but I'm very interested in the idea of organization, and I think that's very helpful to think about how the material impacts your approach to it.
Mm.
And then how you creatively organize it in response to sort of the dual constraints of what's available for you to use.
Sure.
And the point you're trying to...
Well you certainly can't sort of stress too much that there are these various limiting factors in play. I mean, there is, you know, frankly, availability, you're completely correct. Probably last year, 2015, was a year that was affected as much by that as any other when I've been doing a best of the year, if not more so. There were several quite major stories that were simply not available to include in any of the year's best out there in the world. And I know that given, the ability to reprint the stories, that, say, Greg Egan's The 4,000, The 800 would have been in every single science fiction year's best and science fiction fantasy year's best in the field. And I'm confident that Slow Bullets by Alistair Reynolds would have been as well. And both would have been in Paula Garand's now-defunct Year's Best Novellas series. So, you know, availability is increasingly an issue. And with more and more novellas coming out and being very attractive and interesting to reprint, but quite often being unavailable or impractical to reprint, that's a factor. And when you get high-end, expensive anthologies, quite, you know, more and more those stories can be tied down for a couple of years. You can't use those. So availability is a factor. Awareness is a factor. You've got to find stories and know that they exist. You've got to then be able to negotiate with the authors. Sometimes you just can't come to an agreement as to the conditions surrounding, you know, reprinting a story, which is unfortunate, but happens. It's a realistic thing. And then you're trying to, you know, sort of find a balance that's going to make it attractive to readers as well. So there's all kinds of different factors that come down to it before you ever get the chance to ever arrange the stories that you know, sort of, you might, you know. So it keeps you thinking.
So is the short fiction field growing or shrinking?
Oh, boy.
Listen to a recent episode of Goodread or not.
No, I'm not going to do that to you at all. No, that would be terribly unfair. Okay.
To be quite honest, I mean, I can't keep up. I'm amazed you can. And I subscribe to, I think, 8 periodicals at this point, and I can't keep up. I can't even pretend to keep up anymore. So, but it's not my job, of course.
Look, I think with maybe one or two exceptions, almost all of the year's best editors would admit that keeping up is an enormous challenge. It's almost a full-time job. Certainly, nobody gets paid to do a full-time job to keep up, which is an issue. You know, the year's best don't pay particularly well to edit, so you're not going to be able to devote all of your time to it. I guess what it is you develop filtering mechanisms. I mean, I've spoken about this elsewhere before. Back in the day when I read for pleasure, I would read all of those things that you're talking about, and I would simply slog through everything. I would read every issue of Asimov's Analog, FNSF. I would read all of whatever the various other periodicals of the day were. Now it's a matter of filtering and sorting and sampling. I mean, I've now read an awfully large number of manuscripts and stories over the years. And so, you know, I don't read, you know, like I'll pick up the latest Asimov's and I'll know in 3 pages if that novella is going to be one that I'm likely to be interested in reprinting. So, right. I'll never finish reading it if those 3 pages don't get me, because I'm applying a very particular criteria, and the criteria I'm applying is it the best of the year? Not is it good? Is it passingly interesting? So you tend to sample lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of stories, and read the full text of small numbers of stories, and it's the only way you can physically do it. And even then, I mean, I think everybody, if they're honest, would say, no, I don't read everything, no, I don't see everything, but I try. But there's always something published somewhere that will slide by you, and then you're left going, where the hell did that come from? and then there are things that you don't get access to. I mean, for example, there are more and more author Patreon things where, you know, the authors set up and write stories once a month and send them directly to their patrons or the Patreons. And if you're not a Patreon, then you don't get to see this batch of Nora Jemison stories or that batch of Madeline Ashby stories or whatever it might be, or Cameron Hurley stories, and you only see them later on when they're effectively reprinted. And then you have to make a judgment call as to whether they're reprinted or just being published. But, yeah, it is a matter of, to synopsize the answer again, filtering, sorting, and one of the roles of those reviews. I mean, you sit there and you'll read... I may read 6 reviews of an issue of a magazine before I get to read the magazine. And if 6 people have said that story is actually rubbish, maybe you're going to read a page of it and be in and out. But you do have to make up your mind. But then, yeah.
Do you read for pleasure anymore?
I try to.
I took your role for there for a second.
A couple of years ago, when I moved my Year's Best series from Nightshade Books to Solaris, I gave myself the gift of moving that book a couple of months into the future. And from January to March, I try to read for pleasure.
Do you concentrate just on novels or still the short? Okay.
I basically, for that period of time, even though the magazines and anthologies and collections are coming in, I don't look at them. Because it would just break something for a start, you know, in me if I just was always reading things that I had to read, and certainly it's even easy to stop enjoying writers whose work that you used to enjoy simply because you now have to read them. You know, when someone comes along and says, hey, there's a new Tim Powers novel out, you go, yes, that's brilliant, I love Tim Powers. And someone goes, here's a new Tim Powers novel and you've got to get it read in a week. And you're going, oh, okay. And they do that two or three times. You go, oh, not another Tim Powers novel, oh my God. You know, and you lose the fact that you love Tim Powers novels. So
luckily, he types slow.
But in that January through March period, it's like, okay, whatever sort of falls in, whatever I stumble across in a bookshop, I won't go researching it. I won't set it aside. I'll read a Bruce Springsteen biography or something, or any old thing, just to try and keep fresh. Probably it's also the time, if I'm honest, where I do try and follow some of the best novels of the year. I mean, I am supposed to be the reviews editor for Locus, and you try to keep track of new and interesting novels and do, you know, a write-up for them. But if you're only going to read 15 or 20 novels in a year, you're not getting the kind of traction that you used to get. I mean, I remember back in the early 1990s, when I was reading a lot, I felt a lot more than I do now, I would end up getting the Locus recommended reading list and checking off everything that I'd already read, and usually I would have read 80 to 90% of what was on the recommended reading list before it came out. And that sort of is, you know, that makes you more aware of the feel of field. It's probably one of the reasons why I feel so much simpatico with the 80s, particularly the mid to late 80s of science fiction and fantasy.
Question I had was, Are there any, after hearing you say all this about your thought process as you put things together, are there any anthologies, either current or in the past, that you have, I don't know, a sense of admiration about specifically how they were edited or how they were pulled together?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. For a start, there's a pair of anthologies that Kelly Link and Gavin Grant edited for Candlewick Books. There's a steampunk anthology and I think it's a book of monster stories. The titles escape me right at the moment. But they are fabulous books. And they're fabulous books because they've got great stories, because they're really well constructed, and because they have writers writing against their typical sort of sphere of work in a really interesting way. And that's why you get, you know, a story like, say, Paolo Bacigalupi's Mariabe's Children a couple of years ago came from one of those anthologies. And it's a fabulous story, one of the best things Paolo's ever written, in my opinion. And could only have happened in the space of that book. I mean, if you cast back further, I loved and adored Terry Windling's Fairy, which was done as part of the Ace Exclamation series that was mostly done by Dan and Dazois, but, you know, she did that. And that was a really wonderful and actually really, really influential anthology on me. Probably the single anthology that I admire the most would be Michael Bishop's Light Years and Dark, which originally was going to come out under the title of Cosmopedia or something awful, but came out from Berkeley in 1984 and introduced me to more of my favorite writers than any other book in my life. You know, that's where I first read Le Guin and Waldrop and Carter Schultz and Gardner Dazois and on and on and on and on. And then the Year's Best of Terry Carr, which I think are the gold standard of the field. You know, they are really intelligently put together. I mean, I would be fascinated to see how Terry, had he lived this long, how he would have coped with the modern era. I mean, we were referring a minute ago to how the field has grown and, you know, so talking about the state of the field, whether the field is healthy. We didn't actually go into it in detail, but there's that sort of question to ask. And this enormous proliferation of science fiction and fantasy and horror across a broad spectrum and across more and more countries, more nationalities, more ethnicities, whatever else. And how someone with his clarity and perspicacity would have brought it together in a 100,000-word book, because that's, in some ways, I guess, the true test. When you can you meaningfully, you know, sort of reduce 10, 15, 20,000 stories to 12? And if so, what goes in and what goes out, and how do you balance that? I would love to have had the chance to see that, you know, because the field really is. I mean, I was on a panel at Worldcon in Kansas City earlier this year where we were going to discuss the state of short fiction. And the short fiction field is in a very curious state of flux. It's difficult to make a living in for anybody at any point. It's challenging for readers to find exactly what they want. but it's also changed in a really healthy way because it does have all of these different ethnicities, this ability to read deeply in one particular small area and then maybe bring that experience back to your broader reading. I just had a anthology land in my inbox of Iraqi science fiction. So I'm fascinated.
Oh, yeah, I saw that. Right.
Which I'm fascinated
plus one or something?
Yeah, basically I've taken the really, really interesting idea of sort of saying, like, let's look at, you know, the invasion of Iraq and go forward a century, and where is Iraq then? And they've gotten Iraqi science fiction writers to do it. So I haven't had a chance to read the book yet, but I'm really fascinated to see what they've done with that, because that strikes me as exactly the kind of thing we should be seeing. And there's been really great stuff for, you know, in the Afrofuturism area. There's been stuff around the United States, all kinds of great things. How you bring those back into used bests, I don't know. I mean, we have more used bests right now than ever before. It's entirely possible that for some people, the only short fiction they ever read are used bests, so it's more important than ever that you actually provide a broad spectrum of, you know, in your books. But is the field healthy? I truly don't know. I mean, I'm always worried when the field is dependent on patronage, on non-commercial models, and an awful lot of the short fiction that's get published is published on a non-commercial model, which means it can disappear at any point. And that's a little bit of a concern, you know. But on the other hand, you know, I'm working, and Tor publishing fabulous stuff, and Clark's World are publishing fabulous stuff, and so is Lightspeed, and so is Beneath Ceaseless Skies, and so is Apex, and so is Interzone, and FNSF, and, you know, so there's an incredible amount of stuff. I would be curious at some point to sit down with a batch of writers and go, since I think I know the two things you want from writing short fiction, do you get them? I mean, the two things presumably any reader writer wants are readers and money. And how many people are getting enough of those two things, eyeballs and money, I don't know. And that will be what determines what happens next in the short fiction field. I wouldn't be shocked that to see that the story for the next 10 years is contraction rather than expansion. And not necessarily in terms of number of readers, but in markets. In markets, basically having atomized, recoalescing back into a core group of markets that are much more diverse and interesting, but nonetheless are more focused. So because they're the ones that are actually both commercially viable and able to attract enough readers to be, you know, functional and worthwhile.
Do you have a dream anthology that you either A, couldn't do just because of contractual realities, or would just be too big of a project to take on?
I've got a failed one, which is really not the most attractive thing to admit. I was going to edit a big anthology in the mode of legends, you know, the George Martin and Robert Silverberg books.
Mm-hmm.
And we had pretty much everybody lined up. Jack Dann and I were going to co-edit. I think Robert Jordan was involved. He had agreed to write for it. So it was just before he died. So Jordan was in. There was Goodkind was in. I think Martin was in. Silverberg was in. A bunch of other people. And we came within about 2 inches of actually getting it all signed and making it work out and being enormous. And I think it really would have been something special. But we just, for whatever reason, it gets very complicated when you start dealing with people in that kind of commercial space, you know, right. You get into considerations, and I don't know whether it would be the case now, but I got the impression that Tor would have taken it poorly if Robert Jordan had published Wheel of Time work with anyone other than Tor. So you had to sort of play with that. And I would imagine today, in all fairness, I would think that Bantam would be very displeased if any Song of Ice and Fire work appeared anywhere other than from them, and so would work to make that from happening. But doing a big book like that was something that didn't work out that I'd love to have happened. I have a couple of fantasy projects that I would love to do. I was going to do a Landmark tribute anthology, but I just could not get the estate lined up. They had a few requirements that I couldn't meet, and I thought it would have been a lot of fun to go around. So many of the best fantasy writers working today are deeply influenced by Lankmar and Fafhrd the Grey Mouser. And to have them not write Fafhrd the Grey Mouser stories, but to have them write Lankmar stories would have been enormous fun. And there was, at the time I was working at it, a chunk of unpublished Lankmar. It's subsequently come out, but the thought was, you know, have the chunk of unpublished Lankmar with some explanatory material around it, and have other people writing in that space. And I think that would have been huge fun. But again, the contractual requirements just were not practical. So, you know. And look, you just move on and find the next thing. You know, it happens over a long period of your life. I mean, 20 years in anyone's life is a fair chunk. And there's always something else. I mean, I wanted to work on compiling the collected stories of Robert Heinlein. But that proved not to be possible for various reasons, you know. I still think that's something that should exist in the world. And ideally before people stop caring that it does exist in the world. And there are other things, but, you know, life always throws something new up at you, and there's always, you know, more to do as long as you're keeping active.
Yeah, books that don't exist.
Well, I at one point I started a series of blog posts about on books, and that's what led to doing this. In fact, the Stan Robinson book was a direct output result of writing an on books post about the best of Stan Robinson I would have put together if I was the only person putting it together. And I must be now four times I've tried to put to pitch and land a best of Greg Egan, because I think the world would be a better place with a best of Greg Egan in it. But that's just not going to happen. So, you know,
because of the publishers or because of Greg Egan?
Initially, I think it took a while to produce to persuade the publishers. And then Greg, I think, became reluctant purely because he had recently reissued all of his collections and they were all out there in the marketplace doing very well. And I think he understandably took the position that he was better off having a whole bunch of successful short story collections out of there rather than one category killer best of collection that might knock out all of the rest. So I couldn't fault him for that reasoning at all. I mean, I think that's part of the reason why it's only now you're seeing the Best of Le Guin collections coming out.
Right.
Because for many, many, many years, apparently, I hear apocryphally, I don't know her very well, but apparently she was opposed to it for a long time. And it's only just been the last few years that, you know, you saw the one that came out from Small Beer, and now you're seeing the books coming out from Saga. But I think, I mean, also the other thing is, I mean, in truth, no one would let me do the Best of Greg Egan that I want to do, even Greg. You know, I've always felt that I would do a book with a black and white photograph cover called Worthless, The Best of Greg Egan, 1982 to 2000 and whatever. He wrote a fabulous story called Worthless, and there is that kind of sense of 1980s sort of bedsit, whiny, gothic band note in some of the early stuff, and it just struck me as being perfect. And everybody looks at me like I'm insane when I suggest this. And I still think it's perfect, and I know it'll never happen, but, you know, that's what life is about.
I mean, I have all the electronic versions of his books, the collections and such, but I would still, I mean, if Subterranean or somebody like that put together Best of Greg Egan, I'd buy it.
Oh, Subterranean.
I bought the...
completely honestly, Subterranean gave me the go-ahead to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But at that point, that was when Greg... I mean, Bill and I are good friends, and we're in touch fairly regularly. And we talk about various ideas. We worked together on stuff. And he finally came around to the idea of doing it and said, yes, go talk to Greg, land the book, we'll do it. And it was at that point Greg said, well, actually, the world has moved on, and I think not right now. So, I mean, look, maybe it will happen in another 5 years or so. You never know. But I think that Greg has written some of the greatest science fiction short stories we've ever seen. And I think that every now and again you get a writer who comes along, and they write this batch, this clade of short stories that overwhelms the field for a while. No. You can see it when Niven did it. You can see it when Varley did it. And I think you can see it when Egan did it as well. Around the time when Learning to Be Me and Reasons to Be Cheerful and those stories came out. And I think it would be great to see that reflected in a book like a best of. So.
Yes. Yep.
Wow.
Yeah.
But we shall see.
Now I'm sad.
Don't be too sad. There are many, many books to buy, And, you know, and Greg has a new novel coming out in the middle of next year and is writing short fiction at the moment. And I'm sure we'll, no doubt, one day acquiesce and we'll see it happen.
All right, before we move on, Jeff, do you want to...
No, I'm going to step away for a minute, but keep going. Okay. I'm good for a bit, so.
Okay.
Go ahead.
No, you finish, and then I'll ask my question.
No, go ahead.
Okay. I want to talk a little about some of the independent anthologies. So you did The Starry Rift.
Yep.
And Drowned Worlds.
Mm-hmm.
Are they harder to sell than an ongoing series like Infinity? I mean, as far as harder to sell to the publisher?
Not at all. Those two books both sold pretty well, but pretty easily, and were completely different life experiences to sell. I mean, back when I sold The Starry Rift, science fiction anthologies were selling well in the world. Young adult science fiction was selling spectacularly well right at that time. And I was talking to Sharon November, who's a wonderful editor who was working for Viking Penguin at the time. And I went to her with the idea that, and I'm trying to try and explain this without making it sound too tangled. The idea was, everybody keeps trying to do young adult science fiction the way Robert Heinlein used to do it, right? And so they want to do the old style juveniles, but for today. The problem I suggested was that Robert Heinlein was at that point, you know, His juveniles had been written 50 years earlier. To try and emulate those books now was folly. You needed the latest and newest writers in the field to come along and write in that space. And so I got this great lineup of people. There were all kinds of problems getting the book published. It was a nightmare to get it to come out in the end. But selling it was really easy. Drowned Worlds is one of a series... I mean, in some ways, Drowned Worlds is almost like an Infinity book for me.
What I was going to ask. Yeah.
It's sold just exactly the way the Infinity books are sold. I have a wonderful relationship that I value hugely with Solaris Books. And we've done, 10 books together or 12 books together or something. And with Drowned Worlds, honestly, I sent them an email with a couple of paragraphs of text saying, these are the books I'm thinking about doing. Which one do you think would be fun to do together? And they picked Drowned Worlds and another one off the list, and that's what we did. So it wasn't any challenge at all. There was no great difficulty in finding a home for it. Unlike any number of others that sit in my anthologies development folder, unable to find a home. But that one, just in no time at all, was in the hands of Solaris, just as Infinity War sold very, very simply, and as Infinity's End has sold very simply. So, yeah. But, I mean, if you want to talk about a book that I couldn't sell, I mean, Blowing Shit Up was a book that I couldn't sell, that I was, you know, could not find a market for. Same for Lights in the Darkness, which is a book I was going to do with Elisa Krasnstein. We couldn't find a home for it. And there was a book that I was going to do with Ellen Datlow, dark science fiction horror crossover anthology, which was going to be called... Well, she took the title. What was it? For the book she did for She-Zine. Fearful Symmetries was going to be the title of the book. But we just couldn't find a home for it that was going to work out, which will happen sometimes. But anything with Solaris, almost every time, has found a home easily. Probably the only thing that I've not been able to do is, having done the two Fearsome books, they were very satisfying and artistically, creatively successful, but didn't find the kind of readership that would allow us to continue doing them.
Mm-hmm.
So, why do you think that is?
I think there's probably a couple of reasons. The first one is, I think that the covers, as strong as they are, don't really connect properly with what's inside the book. And I think that threw readers off. I also think that there is a interesting disconnect between science fiction and fantasy at short fiction lengths. Short science fiction reads quite a lot like long science fiction. If you like science fiction novels, there's a very good chance that you're going to like science fiction short fiction. However, there is an immersive element to successful long-form fantasy that you tend not to get in short-form fantasy. So it's harder, a lot harder, I think, to connect with readers with short-form fantasy anthologies. And that's why, in fact, paradoxically, unlike at book length, short science fiction tends to sell a lot better than short fantasy. And probably the only exception to that in recent years that I can think of are the Guard that Desired George Martin anthologies, you know, Dangerous Women and Warriors and those sort of things.
Wow.
Yeah.
One of those things that I hadn't really, you know, put two and two together when it comes to readerships like that.
But you can see it when you think about it. I mean, epic fantasy is enormously popular and has been since the 1970s. And it does involve immersion, and it does involve a particular kind of story development, and always will. It's probably why I wouldn't be surprised to see more anthologies of novella-length fantasy. The only thing arguing against that right now is that there is a very healthy and expanding novella market, so that might keep those stories out of anthologies and have them standing alone in book form themselves, which is a perfectly reasonable thing to do. But short science fiction? No, I mean, that's where it's at in terms of short work, I think, and will be for a while, so, you know. But I hope to do more fantasy anthologies. That's what I'm trying to sell the most at the moment. I mean, I've just sold another Best Of and another Infinity book, which is wonderful, but I'm trying to sell some fantasy books.
Can you give us a hint as to what the next Infinity book will
We're up to book 7 now, which I can barely believe. I mean, well, Engineering Infinity wasn't supposed to be the first in the series. Even Edge of Infinity wasn't supposed to be really a follow-up to it. It's just sort of the way it worked, and we ran it together, and then the Infinity Project becomes a thing, right? And we've just had the fifth one come out. Bridging Infinity is just out, like, right now. And that's out in the world. That's the, you know, enormous engineering solutions to terrible problems kind of thing. And hopefully there's sort of, you know, that crossover between Dyson spheres and, you know, tearing down stars and rebuilding them, kind of wonderful enormous galactic scale stuff you get in science fiction. Then the next one, which is coming out middle of next year, I think, is Infinity Wars, which is the military science fiction, if you like, and space wars version of Infinity. And then Infinity's end is going to be more like Edge of Infinity, I think. In some ways, I think Edge is the most successful of the books. It's the one that, in some ways, that I'm the most satisfied with. And so it's moving back to that kind of space. I have to stress that, you know, that it's not the last Infinity book. It just happens to be the title that we've come up with. One of the great challenges that I would never have imagined at the beginning of all of this is coming up with titles that include the word Infinity that don't sound ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know, once you've been beyond infinity, into the edge of infinity, and you've reached for infinity, and you've met infinity, it gets kind of tricky after a while.
In the back pantry of infinity.
A little bit, yeah. But it's helped keep the series, you know, it keeps me fresh trying to think of how I can find themes and ideas that I really am interested in exploring, and that I really seriously think I can get writers to write about. And that's a huge part of it. You've got to be able to feel like you can get writers to write something worthwhile about it. And that also, at the same time, I can find a title that will fit with. So, you know, but hopefully there will be more Infinities. I mean, certainly through to 2018, 2019, we're good for years, bests and Infinities, which is great. But Infinity's End is the one that's just been agreed on in the last week.
I'll take my money for the engineering one, because I've said before, the space opera, the two space opera anthologies, and Godlike Machines are amongst my favorite anthologies of all of them. I had you sign them in D.C.
Yes.
Here in Georgia, I have not unpacked, but those books are out. So,
well, I'm delighted to hear it. I mean, you want to talk about books that, I mean, you prod my memory. I mean, a book that we tried to sell to the world was A New Space Opera 3. We really did want that to be an ongoing series, but we just couldn't make that happen in the real world, unfortunately. And unfortunately, I mean, Godlike Machines is a book I love and was very proud of. I was happy to come out from the SFBC, who are fabulous. But it also was, it's one of two books that I've edited over the years that was struck by publishing misfortune. Right at the time it was due to come out, the publisher changed owners a couple of times, and that delayed the book a couple of times and caused issues with it coming out. And we'd always hoped that it would come out to a trade edition and be out, you know, for more readers. But the timing, the eventual, at that point, reprinting of several of the stories. I mean, the reprinting of the Al Reynolds story at the time was a bit of an issue. So there's all this kind of stuff just compelled to keep them to smaller audiences or to stop the series continuing. But I love the books, and I'm really, really happy that you enjoyed them.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I would love to see some more of the space opera books. That's too bad. But
look, I'm sure Gardner and I will have another swing at it sometime. You know, it's one of those things I'd like to come back to. Gardner and I talk about it every now and again. Just like, I mean, I would love to do an update on the Locus Awards. I think it's about time for it. I mean, that came out in 2004, so we've had 12 more years of Locus Awards, so it'd be nice to update and expand it if we could, but, you know, we'll just have to see what happens.
And now we turn to cult, where each of us gets to talk about things we have read or heard or have experienced in some way.
Okay. Let me think. I just read Alistair Reynolds' latest novel, Revenger, which is probably the single most enjoyable book of his that I've ever read. It is a fast-paced space pirate adventure that crosses over between young adult fiction and adult fiction and is really, really engaging, and I recommend very highly. I also just read Delia Sherman's The Evil Wizard Smallbone, which is fabulous fun. I really, really enjoyed it as well and would recommend it highly. I've been watching a disproportionate amount of genre-related television. Everything's coming back, as you know. At this time of the year, I was one of those people who lined up and binge-watched Luke Cage, the latest of the Marvel series. And whilst it's not perfect, it's really very, very, very good. And I would, again, recommend it. And I've been watching sort of some goofy science fiction stuff. There's an awful lot of, for some reason, time travel stuff. I just watched Class, the Doctor Who spin-off, which was interesting and hopefully will become better. And I just watched the latest episodes of Timeless, which was great. So I think that's most of the culture I've been consuming over the last week or two. I'm just really working on compiling the best of the year right now. So a batch of the culture I'm consuming are anthologies as well. So I suppose I can shout out to the not terribly long ago release Starlit Wood that has come out from Saga, which has a lot of great stuff in it. Particularly stories by Daryl Gregory and Naomi Novik, which I'd recommend very strongly. So that's my culture concerned.
I got one thing I wanted to bring up that Mr. Stevens might be interested in.
Yes,
I found
this
a
This was on my list for culture consumed.
Oh, what was?
Black Mirror.
Oh yeah. Go ahead. Actually, if you want to talk about it. I just wanted to mention a textbook that I found by Maxwell Norman called Dimensions of the Future, which came out in the early 70s, and it's fiction and essays about the near future, and it seems to have chosen as its theme some of the Rand Corporation predictions of what technologies were going to be predominant in culture up through 2030. So it's a strange science fiction, mildly dystopian anthology written by a scholar trying to adhere to a Rand Corporation project plan, which is a unique experience, if nothing else. So,
wow.
Did you finish Jerusalem, by the way?
No, I have not finished Jerusalem yet. But as John mentioned, I did watch two episodes of Black Mirror Season 3. I've been a fan of that show from the start, and I loved the Christmas episode from a couple years ago. But the two I watched were San Junipero, which I believe was the fourth or fifth, and Hated in the Nation, which was the sixth 90-minute episode, which could quite frankly have been a Hollywood film. You know, obviously, if it had been shot in different style and had done a couple other things. But it was one of those slow build-up stories that was really good. San Junipero kind of left me in a weird place, because part of me was saying, wow, this is a almost strangely disconcerting happy ending. And then I realized that the two protagonists are where they were. And I thought about where I was at that period in time and said, no, 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 that wouldn't be a paradise afterlife for me. So, but I'll let John expand on that if he wants to.
Sure. Well, I mean, I can start with Black Mirror. I watched the first three episodes, and I was not impressed.
Ooh.
That's probably a good way to put it. I liked the first episode to some extent, not for the gimmicky device they were using. Because actually, of the three episodes, I think they went most into the characters themselves and how the conceit that was structuring the episode affected them as people and affected their personalities and their life decisions. But it wasn't great, because it just got... It felt very one note after a while. And you could see pretty clearly where it was going. And it just didn't fulfill all the things I expect out of a good Black Mirror episode. And then the second episode was okay. Not particularly memorable. But the third episode was terrible. A lot of other people are saying it's you know, their favorite, it's the best. And it was just so transparently... structured with no regard for reality or how people would actually act, and has, you know, an antagonist that is utterly perfect and moves the story along just as the screenwriters needed it to move along, that it, you just see right through it. And then all the things the characters do, which are very extreme towards the end, just seem like, you know, embellishments on a really trite plot. And again, there are no surprises. There's no sense of revelation. There's just really poorly thought out science fiction.
You know, that's something that I did notice about the two episodes that I watched, wherein in the previous two seasons it was three stories each, and the Christmas special itself had three stories. The things that I noticed here was that he was not, it was obvious in watching San Junipero that something else was going out, that something else was going on, obvious, other than what we were seeing. And the Hated It in the Nation was such a procedural that you knew there was going to be more information coming farther down the story. That was the point of the story. It was an investigation. And I thought it was fairly clever that he actually said, here's how to avoid the, here's the big surprise ending, by actually couching it in a structure that allows for more and more information the deeper into the story you get. And I thought that was fairly good. A lot of people have asked that the protagonists from that story get their own show, and I would be fully in support of that.
So it's interesting, though. Jeff Vandermeer just today wrote something in The Atlantic about the new season, which is about sort of the humanity that's present in it. But I may have focused too much on the need for a good story that actually made sense and that you didn't feel was just cobbled up like, you know, a poorly thought out fable or something. So I saw that. I didn't read very much since our last podcast, but I am continuing to read Fossil Capital, which is a book about how capitalism and technology came together from the beginning of the Industrial Revolution to create climate change and substantiate it, and, you know, sort of a notion that that the system could only have thrived by treating the environment so cavalierly. So I'm continuing on that. But I did read, I burned through a collection of black and white Zot issues by Scott McCloud.
Uh-huh.
And Zob was one of my favorite books back in the day. So it was nice to have them all in one place to tear through. And I highly recommend Zob because it did some very fresh things at the time. And the way he managed to take sort of old school science fiction and blend it with some seemed like a really good formula, especially for a comic. And I've always enjoyed Zod, and this was really just, I felt like a really good showcase of what the story has to offer. So that was great, and I highly recommend that. And that was my culture consumed. And on to Fred.
All right, well, as you hinted, it has not been that long a period of time since our last podcast, so not much culture consumed. My main thing was to watch the first episode of the Dirk Gently Holistic Detective Agency series, mm-hmm. which is, I never knew, this is actually the second time they tried to do it. It's based more on the, there's a comic, so it's based kind of more on that than I think the books, but it is amusing, and I'm going to really enjoy seeing how it all works together. Elijah Wood, he of the Mr. Frodo Baggins, stars as Todd Brotzman, who's the ends up being Dirk Gently's assistant. Dirk Gently is played by a guy named Samuel Barnett, and I'm still trying to figure out whether I like him or not. But Elijah Woods does a really good job as a very confused person, and gets thrown into this weird story with giant bite marks on the ceiling of a hotel, people being torn apart, psychopathic landlords, 2, 3, or 4 groups of people following him, this crazy holistic detective, and much more. So I'm enjoying that. That's on BBC America, so I assume that it'll make its way around the world at some point. Hopefully it lasts at least long enough to wrap up the first story arc. I mean, it's being described as an anthology series. Speaking of anthologies, so I guess each one will be different. You know, each season will be a different main star or whatever. But I'll be interested to see where it goes. And in order to get ready for that, I read the first comic of 5 issues, the second comic of 5 issues, and started the third one, which is called The Salmon of Doubt, which is, of course, the name of the partial third novel in the series that Douglas Adams worked on shortly before he died. So, amusing stuff. No superheroes this time, just holistic detectives. And that's it for me.
All right. Well, I would like to thank Jonathan Strawn for being on our show once again.
My very great pleasure.
That was very illuminating conversation.
Well, I'm delighted to do it anytime. It's been a real pleasure.
Excellent.
Well, hopefully next time we can maybe arrange a duo, you and Gary.
I'm sure we'd be delighted to do it. I mean, Gary's currently in Columbus, Ohio at the World Fantasy Convention. Yep. Mm-hmm. Probably staggering around some restaurant or the bar, actually about now, probably the bar at the hotel in Columbus, knowing Gary. You know, it's a Saturday night there, so they'll all be out having a high old time, so yeah.
Oh, he's probably lining up many, many future episodes of your show, though.
Nah, he doesn't like to do them that way. But I think it'd be one. There should be one in the can, but I think that's about it, so.
No, potential guests,
Yes, exactly, yes.
Yes, and thank you, Jonathan. I mean, honestly, I enjoy the Infinity books. I enjoy the Best of. I enjoyed Solaris. I enjoy the standalones. I enjoy the fantasy. I enjoy your work at and all the other people that are working at Tor on those novellas.
Thank you.
I mean, that's why I was curious. I mean, I'm always curious to hear people say whether they think short fiction is healthy or not, because I think it's a boom.
Well,
an absolute boom.
It kind of is. So, but, you know, commercially, it's a bit tight, but yes. And actually, the one thing I should have said, and I'm going to give you a very quick plug, the next couple of things out with my name on them all come from Tor. So, mm-hmm. Passing Strange by Ellen Klages, which is wonderful and is hugely strongly recommend it comes out in January, and Agents of Dreamland from Caitlin Kiernan comes out in February. And they're the next two things that I've looked at from them, so yeah.
I mean, I really enjoyed the Dream Quest book, and my daughter read it, and my wife is now reading it, so...
Oh, wonderful.
This Lovecraftian reboot is fascinating to me.
Well, I think you're going to see a lot more of it. A lot more. And I recommend, actually, now, if you're interested, try Matt Ruff's book, Lovecraft Country, as well.
Yes, I've got that. Yep. Yeah. But long and short, I mean, you're one of the people responsible for getting me back into short fiction so much, so I want to thank you for that.
Well, I'm delighted. It makes me very happy to hear it, and thank you for actually sort of paying any attention to the book. So I appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Jonathan. We'll put it to bed there.
Okay. Well, thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
Right. And have a good night, everyone.
Okay. Bye.
Yep. Have a good night.
Bye.